The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Some content in this audio is not covered under a Creative Commons license. For more information, see the course materials on the MIT OpenCourseWare website.
Congrats on finishing assignment 2, and we will spend the next couple of weeks grading them, but that was pretty fun on Friday, so I think it worked out pretty well. And, we've been talking these past couple of, we've been talking the past couple of weeks about, serious games for education, games as an art form, as a means of expression. And we're going to be continuing some of those discussions later on. But the whole idea is to prep you for the situation where you're going to make a game for a client, and for this last assignment, you're actually going to be making a game based on a problem that these guys are going to be talking about. Could you introduce?
Sure. My name is Jim Cartran. I'm a clinical psychologist. Work at Beth Dijon, just started at Brigham and Women's Hospital, one of the Harvard Mafia hospitals. And my area is using interactive media for both clinical training, but especially for treatment of clinical problems, so building from computer programs to help treat clinical disorders in psychology.
It's my turn to stand up. So I'm Cesar Campano. I'm a psychiatrist at UMass. I trained in the same place Jim used to work at Beth Israel. And my focus is primarily clinical. I'm an attending psychiatrist in a variety of settings, inpatient, outpatient. And what I brought up to Jim and then to Philip was a practical question that I'm going to try to present, which is helping psychiatry residents deal with the angry, agitated, and potentially disordered patients, as I'm going to say later. This is a significant and largely unknown issue. Certainly, the research is picking up, and people try to understand the extent of the problem. And but I'll say more. I'll save it for the presentation. So thank you for having me here.
So when they contacted me, there was the initial interest in trying to make some sort of digital piece of software to be able to help the training students in learning how to deal with violence or violence in mental institutions. And immediately the first thing I thought is like, well, before we jump right into digital, let's try doing something in analog first. Let's try prototyping something first. But it also occurred to me that in the real world of game design, there's actually a lot more jobs in game design outside of the game industry and inside the game industry. There are a lot of companies out there that are basically looking for solutions, some of which may be games. And you might end up working in some of those capacities. A lot of folks in advertising, for instance, who are involved in games. A lot of folks who are interested in improving teaching methods or improving simulations, working on trying to think of an example, public awareness, and people who are also interested, who are now working in website design and various online services, who are trying to think about how to make their experiences a little bit more game-like. There are really, really good ways of doing them, and there are really, really bad ways of doing them. And for the most part, what we're hoping is that if you end up getting one of those jobs, you're going to be able to bring some of your personal insight as having actually done game design, as opposed to just copying what games have done and just assuming, well, it kind of looks like a game, therefore it is a game. You guys know that now. So this is kind of get your feet wet in terms of designing something, designing for somebody else's needs. The important thing to keep in mind is who's going to be playing your game, or who's this game intended for, and in what context are they going to be playing your game, and what are the particular problems that you're trying to address? What's the part of the system that you're trying to simulate? And what kinds of things, what kinds of insights do you hope people are going to be able to get out of that? The problem they're going to talk about is huge, is vast. If you notice, I uploaded actually like four readings to the class website. Only one of them is required, but all of them are useful. I'm going to be uploading more. These are all reference material for your team to use however you wish. Because the problem is so huge and vast, you don't have to solve the whole problem. You pick one thing that you are excited about, that you're interested about, and that you think that you might have a good strategy, and do the usual brainstorm. We're going to be going through brainstorming and team selection pretty much this week. And try to identify some small part that might be, you know, addressable with a card game or a board game, or I'll talk a little bit about role-playing games in a couple of weeks. So, with that being said, I'm going to hand it over to you guys.
Great.
So who's going to take first?
Cesar will take the lead on this.
Okay, so we'll try to take turns to talk about violence in psychiatry in particular. So, as Philip pointed out, violence is a large issue. What I'm going to try to focus on is, as I mentioned earlier, the relevance in dealing with psychiatric patients, especially psychiatric patients on an inpatient unit, which is what you know, what they actually the request or the question for me came from. Obviously, violence can be looked at in a variety of ways, and I think in one of the handouts that I sent to Philip, violence and mental illness. They talk about the biological, the psychological theories, the social dimension of violence and how it can be understood. If you look at the human development, and no matter what theory you consider, either traditional drive-based theory like Freud or Erikson stages, each seems to define a certain developmental goal. And often achieving in a faulty way that goal can create the potential for aggression and sometimes violence. A little child or an adult whose dependent oral needs are frustrated may try to take over and get those those met in a way or another. So. What I use as if you under the metaphor for the origins of violence is the communication breakdown. At some level, something doesn't happen right between, you know, the person who gets angry and those around him or her. So, in the most generic way, basically communication, as Les well said, is about who says what to whom, and in what channel, and with what effect. The breakdown can occur at many levels, and again, this is the generic form. I hope I'll make it clear what I mean, and especially what can be done at a practical level when you're, let's say, the resident on call at night, and the staff calls you up and says, so-and-so is getting out of control, she's raising her voice, threatening, pounding walls, wanting to get out, refusing medications. How do you approach such a person? And again, the intervention can happen at different levels. And actually, one goal of the training or potentially the game that you might consider is what to do. How do you establish when to engage fully by yourself with outside help, when the intervention is minimal and you just bring hands with you, restrain the patient, use pharmacology. So it's a continuum of interventions. I'm going to just focus on what to do when you can actually engage the patient. Again, continuing the metaphor is what people have, what Walter Fisher has described as this type of narrative rationality, as opposed to the traditional rational paradigm that defines people as thinking beings that have actually to make decisions and base their actions on evidential reasoning. We're rational people. We analyze the situation and come up with the best possible outcome. Walter Fisher talks about the fact that we are all storytellers, that we try to interact, understand others based on a narrative that we have about ourselves and about others. My assumption, and again, this is just the introductory metaphor, if you want, that at some point violence can be caused by a disruption in this narrative. Things don't make sense anymore. We feel misunderstood. We feel the victim of an injustice. And those principles apply to somebody who's struggling with a mental illness, where things are, you know, have a much narrower window of opportunity than the people who are able to flexibly adapt to the demands of reality. So we all know who this is, and the reason I put it up, and I have to admit I haven't looked into the copyright part of this. I know there are longer and longer copyright rules for using cartoons, so you'll have to forgive me. My point is that this is an angry person, as someone who's communicating, I think we get quickly and clearly the fact that his emotional range may be intense, but it's fairly narrow. Doesn't cover wide broad spectrum, and the communication is fairly simple. He's in distress. He's imposing his point of view. He needs space. He could become very aggressive and assaultive. I think that the language is very simplistic. How would we approach the Hulk and trying to calm him down and change his color? Well, again, that's the end of my introductory metaphor. Briefly, and please, feel free to interrupt, jump in, and make this presentation as long as short as you want me to. There are many slides. I'm not going to go through every single line. I'm just using this as a stimulus for the conversation, especially from your perspective and from your needs. As I said, I'm a clinical provider. I'm a psychiatrist. I deal with patients all the time, many of whom are angry or potentially assaultive, and I may do things after so many years instinctively, but sometimes I have to think through, okay, this is the situation, how do I do to maximize the benefit for the patient I'm treating and to keep myself safe. I've been assaulted just once in 15 years, and it was like in the movies, a VA patient, former Green Beret, who got upset with the system and picked up a very heavy armchair and lifted it above his head, and we established eye contact, and I think he wondered, what should I do with this puny little doctor? Should I squash him or not? And in the end, I guess it was a last split second moment. He decided to throw it to my side. A large section of the wall came down, so I was wondering, I could have been that wall coming down. He ran out. It took him, a while to be people to catch up with him, and two cruisers full of police officers to subdue him. So I guess no communication there. He was just subdued. What's the magnitude of the problem? I think it's substantial. And actually, more than 10 years ago, there were some isolated reports of how significant the problem was in terms of trainees, and especially psychiatry trainees, being the target of verbal and physical violence. On this first page, I talk about medical students in one study. Numbers are relatively small, but again, the study is 14 years old. A survey of psychiatry residents showed that assault or threats of violence are clearly one of the most difficult events in their training, and some were wondering retrospectively if this is the right field for them. Actually, some students may wonder, reading this literature, whether psychiatry is the right field for them to go into. And as you see, the fourth article, almost two-thirds of psychiatry residents were assaulted at least once during their training. And obviously, like with any kind of dangerous situation, the risk of post-traumatic symptoms can be substantial, either an acute stress response or longer-lasting issues. The idea of improving their training and their ability to deal with the situation has multiple benefits. Those who know what to do are almost never assaulted. Not only that, if they happen to be exposed, the likelihood of developing post-traumatic symptoms goes down significantly. So I don't think I need to demonstrate that point any further. The assault rate in a more detailed and relatively more recent study, 10 years old, pretty old, you see that overall the number of assault rate was 30 to 40%. Men tended to be slightly more frequently assaulted than women.
Can you define what assault means exactly? What qualifies as assault?
Assault basically means kind of laying hands on the person and the assault resulting in an injury of any kind. Skin, being kind of broken through or some kind
so
of injury.
So just holding the clinician wouldn't be an assault?
Well, it would be an assault because that such a kind of grabbing action could actually result in an injury. I think it would be probably very limiting to talk only about physical injuries, mm-hmm. especially since the psychological consequences are often the longer lasting and much more more significant. I think what the surveys have shown also is that how unprepared trainees in the mental health and outside the mental health field are, actually. Often this is reduced to a few lectures, especially during orientation, and then they are thrown into the lion cage and they learn on the job. Many of these findings are retrospective. Many trainees felt that, well, I didn't say anything because I thought I was supposed to just toughen up and bite the bullet and move on, or this is part of the job. I chose this, it's my fault. Or maybe I did something wrong. Maybe I was the one who made it so that the assault happened. So a lot of reasons that were just, again, not looked into. Fear of being scrutinized. How come that I'm the only one who assaulted among 10 trainees? How I'm going to explain this? I was so frightened that I cannot even remember clearly what happened to me. So there are a variety of reasons why people who are in training. And again, I'm focusing on, and again, on a very small segment, a specific group of trainees in medical and psychiatric training. But I could easily think of other situations of people who are kind of exposed to the potential for violence and where such training could be helpful. Until now, and for the most part, the data that I was able to collect, and most people in looking at this have been able to collect, is fairly limited. There are certain limited number of programs. Methodologically, the research is quite faulty. You can just talk about how limited the generalizability of the findings are. And often, people talk about what happened in the past. So clearly, the recall bias is a major limiting factor in understanding what happened. Also, as Jim asked me, so how do you define assault? One of the biggest problems with most research in this field is that defining assault aggression is done in very idiosyncratic ways. It's hard to compare different studies. So this is a compilation of what people in different areas have thought about in terms of improving the psychiatric training. And as you see, and most often in the last few years, the idea of using simulation expose the trainees to a protected environment that has clearly defined boundaries and consequences, and basically that can be repeated almost in identical fashion in order to gain proficiency, is coming up more and more. Many training programs are doing is to use standardized patients that use actors and that of course will behave in a programmed fashion. They may get up to you and make fists, but hopefully they'll not get so much into the role and end up punching you. So
I think this is the real challenge, is that there's different levels of learning. You can learn kind of a list of facts, things to do if your patient starts to get agitated and threatening, and you can learn that and take a test on it and forget it the next day, especially if it doesn't come up for you right away. And then there's the question of internalizing it, so you actually have a not just a kind of a working knowledge of it, but really understand what you should do in different kinds of circumstances. And that's where the idea of role playing with live role plays for the trainees, for the residents, and mental health providers can really be helpful, so that they've had some semblance of this kind of training. But it's the tricky thing with these role plays is it's not easy to ensure that everybody receives high quality access to well trained actor. Here in Harvard Medical School, they probably do. UMass probably do. But there's a lot of places. And if you expand it beyond psychiatry to every mental health center in the country, every caseworker who's going out to visit a patient at their home, or a social worker, they're definitely not getting this kind of training. And so, the ones who really, I think you said before, are really well trained are the nurses, actually, because they get a different kind of training that's really pretty effective, it sounds like. But the mental health care providers often have no training, and then they're the ones who are kind of in a closed room with the person who can become really violent, especially because at their home or in an inpatient unit.
Yeah, Jim was making reference to that psychiatrist at MGH who last year was stabbed by a patient in the outpatient clinic, and they have read or...
You don't hear about this last year? Can you just describe the situation?
Well, it was late in the evening when most things like this have the potential of happening. And this was a new evaluation for this psychiatrist in the bipolar disorder clinic at MGH. And basically, he was angry from the beginning and was able to stab repeatedly. An off-guard person just happened to walk by.
It was a police officer, right?
Yeah, he was one of the security people for that particular clinic, and he came, apparently had a gun. I don't know how often off-duty security people carry their guns with him, but he opened fire and killed the patient, so he was charged, I think. Eventually was cleared, but for using excessive force.
What happened to the psychiatrist?
Well, the psychiatrist was admitted into a hospital and required extensive surgeries, and I think she was stabbed in the chest and in the neck, and it was a fairly gruesome. She survived, and I think she's back at work. But this is an extreme case, and I'm afraid that many of the things that we talk about, the principles that we may come up with, may not necessarily be so helpful, other than thinking back at a level of intervention. It's quite conceivable that for somebody who charges at you, you won't be able to talk him down, you won't be able to use any of the nice de-escalation principles that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. But figuring out what to do, I think, remains important.
So I have a question. You mentioned that nurses have sort of like a different training system for this, and it seems to be effective. But what is that training? What is different about what nurses get taught?
There are some, in most states, there are some regulations that try to implement some level of training designed specifically for patients who get out of control. And that's not only psychiatry. Emergency room teams have probably the most, one of the most kind of, the highest rate of assaulted patients across diagnostic boundaries. Often psychiatric patients, especially patients using substance abuse, will get out of control in the emergency room. So, if you want to become an emergency physician, or if you work in the field as an EMT or another capacity, you will have to deal with these situations. What makes the nurses somewhat better trained is that they often are the frontline staff dealing with out-of-control patients. And I think that's probably sad, because physicians should be equally, and trainees and physicians in training should be equally well trained. But on the nursing front, there has been some progress. In Massachusetts, the Department of Mental Health has some mandatory training. There's a lot of red tape there, but there are a lot of helpful aspects, including aspects related to self-defense. And I wish I could have presented a recording of a training session for staff. When I went to it, I thought it would be something like a very spectacular kind of kung fu, how you do it. But in fact, the emphasis is how to keep yourself safe, and believe it or not, how to keep the person safe, the person that you're kind of blocking the punches, the person that might be trying to kind of
strangle you or keep you in a stronghold or scratch you or rip your hair. Again, even when you try to intervene or you're trying to protect yourself and keep the other person safe. So no punching, kicking, no kind of spectacular stunts in that respect. But again, that also I feel could be an interesting topic for a simulation. How do you kind of interact with especially since, again, I'm a total kind of outsider in the field, but I, having kids, they were asking me the other day about Microsoft's Kinect, and I thought that was really interesting because the level of interaction with kind of computer-generated interfaces is very interesting, and certainly it would be a safe bet to be attacked by somebody from the TV.
It sounds like nurses get better training because the states require them to have better training.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right.
So that's in part of it. And I've been trying at UMass to suggest that not only the staff, physicians, get exposed to the training, but even the psychiatry trainees and other trainees, especially in emergency medicine, they should all really know about it in the middle of the
I suspect some of this has to do with the benefits of being in a union, which the union can demand that the nurses receive this better training, where the physicians are not in a union.
And it's also about numbers. I mean, on any unit, you have 6-7 nurses per one physician, and the nurses are there in shifts around the clock. So their likelihood of being exposed to an out-of-control patient is much higher. Usually, on these units, people intervene as a team, and there's a team leader that tries to apply many of the principles that I hope to talk about. And then, if there is need for seclusion or restraints, then that has to be done in a coordinated fashion. And things are very much clearer, as I said, on the nursing front. Maybe because they're doing it all the time, and because there are some tight regulations. Maybe because they're unionized, and at least half of the literature really comes from the nursing direction. So that's a tangent.
I just want to write on the Kinect comment that you were making. I mean, we will be talking a little bit more about live action games. So that's kind of how you prototype something that's going to be a motion gesture or computer game. You don't obviously having to write code to do that sort of body recognition is kind of annoying and expensive. But but you can test out a lot of ideas just by having two people play a physical game. Because safety becomes the biggest concern for the players as well. It's kind of interesting because in this particular case, they're trying to teach someone how to prevent damage to both parties at the same time, which is an interesting. It actually kind of helps you with the design of a live action game. Now that's only one problem. That's not the. You're going into more details about the kinds of things that you can do to prevent it escalating into actual combat. Combat is one of those things that.
And the idea is basically to do your best to not end up at that particular extreme of a direct kind of combat, which is not. So ideally, you don't have to go there. And as I said, in 15 years, I've been assaulted once. I'm sure I was lucky. People think that my eyebrows are intimidating, so patients don't tend to get very friendly. And again, I'm gonna tell you about a few pearls and a few tricks that I personally use. It may not be they may not be helpful for everybody. Over time, you develop your own style. The idea is to be able to make an assessment and try to take preventative steps. And I think that's the secret. And this is what I hope better training, maybe the use of simulation and kind of gaming could be helpful people. Okay. So now I'm going to just I'm going to jump into talking about prevention and. Not prevention, but identifying how you assess and how you think about the potential for violence, and these are some known risk factors for aggression. Obviously, the history of violence is the top. How recent? How frequently? those people become assaulted? What's the pattern of escalation? What are the associated symptoms? What happens when before somebody gets becomes assaulted? Why is this important? Because you can do, and probably you should do quickly before engaging with the patient, an assessment at that level, and it will help you figure out how deep to get involved, how likely you are to de-escalate the patient, versus saying, oh, I don't need this, I need help, let's go in as a team. So that makes it important. People often talk about violent threats and fantasies. Young people tend to be more assaulted, and there's no surprise. Also, older people who have dementia and get more disinhibited and more likely to become reactive. I always like to tell the story of a patient with dementia. I was moonlighting, and he swung at me as I was passing. And then I went to talk to him, so what happened? Well, I don't know. He just passed by me, and I was upset, and he was the closest, so I thought I would try to touch him. There was no way for me to predict that. It wasn't a serious thing. It wasn't the predatory type of assaultiveness where somebody plans, doesn't like you, goes after you. A colleague of mine was attacked by a patient. The patient watched when people were not around, went into the doctor's room, locked the door, and started punching. So that's a totally different animal. So the distinction between impulsive, affective, if you want, or type of aggression and the predatory type, is essential to people. In some subcultures, violence is not allowed. Certainly, much more frequent. People of a lower socioeconomic status may be more likely to become assaulted. Patients of a limited cognitive ability, especially when institutionalized, may be more likely to become assaulted. And then it's many diagnoses increase the likelihood of assaultiveness. The top are psychotic disorders like schizophrenia, mood disorders like bipolar. I told you about what we call cognitive disorders, especially dementia and confusional states. Patients that have had traumatic brain injuries or that have epilepsy may be more likely.
The real problem with Iraq veterans coming back or Afghanistan veterans when they have had an IED explode under their vehicle and they had a brain injury, now they have a lot of disinhibition about violence and they can just go off sometimes very unexpectedly.
The frontal lobe exerts an inhibitory influence on our ability to function, and that allows us to plan, to think ahead, to sequence events. Often when this is the executive function of our frontal lobe. When it's impaired, either in a trauma or after surgery, being in an accident, or becoming demented, that ability to operate in that fashion may be impaired. Violence is a possible side effect. Substance abuse, I think, are the top of the list because of the disinhibition, both during the intoxication phase and during the withdrawal phase, people tend to become very agitated and assaulted. There are certain personality disorders. When we think about a personality disorder, we have this enduring maladaptive patterns of relating to you and to others and to the world. The obsessive compulsive personality disorder likes to have things organized, planned, nothing. Even going on vacation is an exhausting task. Nothing has to happen randomly. Grandiose personalities really need this kind of feeding coming from all directions. They need to be in the limelight. They use people, not as real people, but as people that kind of provide sustenance to their own self-esteem. Two types of personality disorders are particularly likely to promote violence. The antisocial, and you may have heard the term borderline personality disorder, which is basically at core has significant instability in emotions, in interpersonal relationships, and identity, basically their lives are a mess. Often they feel abandoned, they feel put down, they may get briefly paranoid, and often they become assaulted. So again, I'm throwing a lot of terms and definitions at you. I don't want to make this kind of lecture about psychiatry, but these are conditions that I think are helpful to think about and to move about. Yeah.
People with delusional disorders like schizophrenia get mild. Is it usually because they're frustrated about something, or is it because they suddenly have some sort of delusion about their clinician that involves
great question.
Requiring them to take some sort of action that is violent?
I think both. I think even people that have a psychotic disorder have the right to feel the victim of an injustice or feel frustrated or many of the reasons that I talked about could happen. But in particular, I think the other point is equally important, that they may act on a delusional conviction, or their psychosis may also have hallucinations, and command auditory hallucinations are known to often be the forerunners of a violent attack. You talk about me and you say things, or the voice tells me, I'm going to go after you. You do it, and the person feels hopeless to resist that. I discharge the patient, was doing great. Next day he comes back. Went home, the voice told him that he needs to hurt his mother, otherwise he will get disemboweled. So he started punching her and then chased her with a knife. She had to hide in, behind, in the neighbor's house until the police arrived. There is an interesting threat control override pair that people have looked at violence have described as being sometimes the proximal cause for violence. People feel directly threatened, and they also have this overpowering, urge that they need to act on that cannot resist. It's a controversial concept. I'm not so sure why I would give it. Give this particular association a higher status than other delusional convictions about the neighbors, watching me or planning to kill me or putting together a variety of clues that my friends are really trying to get rid of me, and then I need to protect myself. But you're absolutely right. What's interesting, even though patients with chronic psychiatric disorders may have their reasons to become assaulted. In the overall bigger scheme of things, when you look at actual violent assaults committed in society, they are responsible for a tiny amount. So it's an interesting way of looking at numbers. Yes, they could become violent, but the reality is that their numbers, in terms of the actual violent act, are very small. But anyway, this may just be a kind of statistical trick.
You're talking about the number of cases of violence. Episodes where compared to the general population.
Exactly.
Okay, so
exactly. That's exactly what I'm trying to make. And then there are various acute findings when you examine the patient on what we call the mental status examination. Obviously, hostility, suspiciousness, agitation are all associated with violence. In terms of I want just to focus 1 minute on the so-called aggressive attributional style. How do we respond to stress when we have the perception of threat? This is the threat override delusion that I mentioned. I think that's probably relevant. And the command hallucinations. What happens in conditions of uncertainty, and many of these patients or people may have to think in a distorted fashion. I was talking at the beginning about communication breakdown. You have the layer of the mental illness that shrinks your options. You have a particular situation to deal with that makes you even more likely to become assaulted, and this constellation of cognitive distortions may make it more likely for you to become assaulted. Neglecting the base information, which kind of assigns a higher weight to certain events, that otherwise are low frequency, attending only to facts that would confirm your assumptions, I think.
Oh, okay. So if the psychiatrist's office calls to reschedule an appointment, the person assumes that this is because the psychiatrist doesn't like him.
Exactly.
This person doesn't want to treat me, they don't like me, they don't want me to be their patient because they rescheduled me.
Ignoring facts that could disconfirm your hypothesis. I just talked to the psychiatrist who was nice to me, but still the fact that he called and canceled is the overriding explanation that he doesn't like me. Or focusing on common events just because you remember them, which is an interesting way of explaining. The fact that you remember them kind of brings them up in the rank. And other disconfirming evidence is totally kind of ignored.
It's like the assumption that the train on the other platform always seems to arrive first, because those are the ones you remember.
Or kind of the garden variety grass is always...
The grass is always...
And I talked about medications and street drugs. Some are more likely to be associated. Alcohol, just by the sheer volume, and especially because withdrawal is so violent, it's a significant issue. The intoxication phase, your level of coordination, your perception of facts, it's just they're so off that you're more likely to lose control. Antidepressants have an interesting impact, because in people that have an underlying tendency to swing in their moods may actually augment those swings. You may have heard of the news of antidepressants promoting violence and suicide in adolescents. And while statisticians are still scratching their heads to figure out the exact numbers, the truth is that mood is very unstable in adolescents, and often initial depression may turn out to be something else. You give somebody an antidepressant, call him or her for follow-up in 6 or 8 months, and meanwhile, lots of things could happen. And I think in those cases, when actually those young adolescents committed suicide, it was not so much about the antidepressant causing it. Probably the antidepressants made the symptoms worse. It was very poor follow-up and a poor diagnostic. But anyway, this is getting too technical. I included this in the last minute. This is an interesting summary of a nationwide study focusing on violence risk assessment. Let me just say 2 minutes about useful measures in assessing dynamic of the violence. People have looked at violence in two ways. They have put together all those factors that I presented initially, and they have looked at retrospectively are those who become violent. And they compiled the history, clinical, risk assessment scale. The problem is that when you're dealing with somebody, those scales, even though they may give you a good image of what happens in the long run, they may not help you deal with the immediate situation. So clinical scales have been used in ILO. One developed in Norway, the other one, the dynamic appraisal, developed in Australia. These are the items for the HCR-20, and it's almost like a repetition of what I said earlier in terms of risk factors. This is the historical risk factors. And these are validated because they have been used for more than 15 years. The clinical scale is the dynamic part of the HCR, and then the risk management scale is trying to project in the future what you have to do in order to ensure safety, what could go wrong,
So the value of these scales is kind of sizing up the likelihood of this person becoming violent.
Exactly.
In the absence of other information. Now, the best predictor is probably what they're actually doing behaviorally in front of you. They're reaching for something heavy. I weigh that heavily. But in the absence of anything else, the people who meet a certain, as you say, certain profile are more likely to be violent in as a psychiatric patient than others.
This is a dynamic scale that looks at what happens in front of you, as you pointed out. You're considering confusion, irritability, how boisterous and how verbally threatening the person is. The most recent one is the dynamic appraisal of the situational aggression that has 7 factors. That seems to be the best one in terms of the assessment or prediction of violence over the next 24 hours. And this is an interesting psychopathy, kind of index. Psychopathy has an interesting history. I think the current version that we all talk about is the antisocial personality, but basically refers to people with minimal capacity for empathy, whose kind of moral dimension is fairly primitive, could engage in stealing, cheating, violence, and don't have a lot of kind of moral drawbacks to do it. It seems to be associated with violence, not surprisingly. And this is actually a factor analysis that identifies those two dimensions. Now, just at the end, I want to talk about the de-escalation principles that I actually am trying to incorporate in the standardized patients, because these should be fairly easy to at least present, and then maybe hopefully to teach the residents how to use in terms of dealing with agitated patients. So, and actually many of them are used by staff. How to start the interaction with a violent patient? How to position yourself within kind of arm's length, probably at 45 degrees, for two reasons. One, to even in case you're attacked, to offer a much smaller surface of the impact, and also to allow you a way to escape if you have to. Not obviously to block the exit or stand over if the person is kind of kneeling down or in the bed. Never turn your back. What to do with your hands? Never make fists or kind of keep your arms crossed or behind you or in your pockets. To kind of appear as non-threatening as possible. How to regulate the eye contact? If it's too intense, it can become bothersome. If it lacks completely, then people could conclude that you're not really interested or involved.
And the thing that's important to keep in mind with a psychiatric patient is, well, a couple of things. One is that mental health patients are much more likely to be the victims of violence than actually to commit violence. And this is, that's really the outlier, the unusual case where the psychiatric patient becomes violent. But obviously it's an important situation. It does happen frequently enough to be a real concern for the providers and for their well-being. But then I think I've lost my train of thought here, but basically there's different levels of what you have to understand how to do. One, how to protect yourself, and then two, how to protect the patient. It's almost like if your child who's 11 years old comes at you swinging, it's really different than if you're getting mugged on the subway in terms of what you're going to do. Now, the person who's sitting in your office might be a lot bigger than your 11-year-old, but you kind of get the idea. You're not trying to punish them. You're not trying to inflict any more harm on them than is absolutely needed in order to stop the situation and for you to get out or let them out.
Yes, and that's important, and that's somewhat counterintuitive, because when I think an interesting aspect, I'm just thinking or trying to think in terms of potential simulation and targets for a training paradigm. I think an important aspect is to for the person who's going through the training to understand himself or herself, what's the reaction when you're threatened, and how to continue to think on your feet and take decisions that are not based on a kind of flight or fight or tend and befriend attitude. This is not about dealing with a common situation. This is when you have to maintain your ability to remain therapeutic and helpful and to minimize harm to yourself, but certainly harm to the other person. And the truth of the matter is that many people in these situations react the way they have, that they have always done. I mean, I gave Jim the example of a social worker I work with who, every time when she's confronted by a patient, she gets angry and she gets defensive and tells things, to her that I find are hurtful and are just kind of, adding gas to the fire. I need to intervene between the two of them. It's almost like, I'm there, the umpire. I say, okay, time out. Stop. We need to do something else. And I try to explain to her. She just doesn't doesn't get it, or you know, can theoretically figure it out, but you know, doesn't do a good job at it. When we are angry or frightened, our behavior, the way we talk, the way we interact, changes, and those things can be major triggers for the other person. So
yeah, if you're staying really calm and the other person's escalating, that's a real dampening force on that other person from escalating even more. And it's really, really hard to do. That's staying professional and recognizing that this aggression is really a medical symptom. Just like if they were bleeding on the floor, that you know, the difference obviously is that it could actually hurt you, the provider. But you know, you need to recognize as a medical symptom that needs to be dealt with, as opposed to taking it really personally or you know, getting violent back.
Yes. How do you appear? How do you, obviously, being calm, centered, self-assured is always helpful. It's the message that you're conveying. Often, if you respond, you know, to anger by being fearful or angry yourself, you know, obviously this will just kind of escalate. Or if you're fidgety and you know, pacing and gesturing yourself and wondering, so what do I do now? I think the other person would clearly pick up that feeling. Touching, most often than not, is not a good idea, even though I mean, instinctively we would like to kind of calm the other person down or wonder what it is. This is how we learn to show kind of empathy and that we care, we want to help. Well, it may not be a good idea. And then this could be a topic in itself. Active listening would be the most, if you want, the buzzword in terms of the verbal de-escalation principle. Often when I'm called, and many of my colleagues are called to deal with such a situation, I introduce myself. I'm telling the person how agitated he is, why I'm here, and I'm trying to understand. I may not respond or react to you know, the person's curses or threatening behavior. Of course, I try to maintain a safe distance and I continue my assessment. Can I deal with this or I need help or I need to stop and find another way? And I give that person feedback about what I see, how he or she makes me feel. I feel, you know, you're threatening. I feel uncomfortable. I think we need to stop. Do you want to talk? What are the issues that you're dealing with? I also explain and set limits on what is acceptable and not acceptable. Often that combination works. I listed pharmacotherapy and seclusion and restraint because they're part of the process, and I think I would like you know, people you know, who are trained you know, for this to understand that those things are available. Any questions so far?
I've just got a couple of comments on the position of the tables.
Yeah, we can do that. And I wanted to suggest, see what you think about this. If someone would like to play the role of a patient, I can meet with you briefly and just kind of prepare you to do that if anybody's interested in taking on the role of the aggressive patient. You'd like to do that?
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't you and I step out for just a couple of minutes and then while you're talking. Does that sound
good?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's going to be a bit of a role play demonstration.
Okay. No, that's
okay. So, so I mean, there's a couple of things that have been brought up that already immediately seem to be possible places where you guys can think of what you're going to do your project on. That's identifying factors, of course. There's a whole bunch of different schemes and different metrics that people have been using, all the way from known personality types to you know to social economic factors and personal history. You can make some kind of kernel working. You know, I can imagine some sort of like, can you figure out enough information before it's too late? That sort of thing. The dynamic assessment of violence seems to be more of a time pressure kind of thing because it's like you almost have to like figure out on the spot. But the factors are very different. But similarly, it's like identifying like this. The de-escalation, the active listening thing is kind of interesting because it almost seems like you could make a word game or a face-to-face kind of party game kind of thing out of that. Of the, can you remember what you're supposed to do with, you know, in conversation with each other without missing any of the points, and that might be something that they could do. So that would be like a live action game, but not necessarily a physical game. It'd be like, you know, like more like a party game. You can imagine working to do things like that.
I mean, one way this is, by the way, I didn't want to go there to make this too long, but these are some parts of a standardized patient that I'm putting together that I'm going to try actually to talk to the simulation department at UMass to, you know, train an actor. And this would be kind of the goals for, you know, the training goals. And I'm really particularly interested in how people respond when they're exposed to an angry situation, mm-hmm. or even to an angry face. Mm-hmm. What do you have to do in order to de-escalate the patient? And I'm going to suggest to the actor is that you are in the room and you're pacing up and down and you're very angry and you're allowed to use some generic swear words and to have a number of complaints. Could be a number of them. Nurse was too late to give the medications, the girlfriend didn't come in time, you owe money, you just had a job interview today and you missed it because you're in the hospital. Could be a number of things. And then the person approaches you. The trainee should follow some rules in terms of the verbal and nonverbal de-escalation. Mm-hmm. If that person is able to engage you, you can become less angry, less agitated, more interested, pacing less, lowering your voice. If the trainee is just doing the right wrong things, you either stay at the same level or get more and more angry. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's fairly demanding for an actor because the non-verbal elements are easy. How you regulate the distance, you know, how you look, how you approach, you know, you inhibit, you know, your natural tendency to kind of pat the person on the shoulder, whatever. But the verbal aspects are more difficult.
Improvising so dialogue on the spot is hard.
Exactly. But at the same time, the goals of the dialogue are not. Mm. Because you should probably find out what's going on. Even though, let's say, the actor will try to tell you about his life and how miserable things are, and, you know, I lost my job, and, you know, I was kicked out. No, but you need to try to bring the person to what really happened. I think that's very, very helpful because you're pinning down a particular conflict that triggered it. And if you're able to do that, then you can take some steps. Okay, I have a patient right now who has difficulty expressing herself. And systematically, there is one particular shift where the staff is not patient, doesn't wait for her. She just needs to give her a little bit more time. And she gets upset and angry and starts pacing. And I have to, every time, say, please listen to her. Or she comes up to me, she tells me the story, and then I go back to the staff. Okay, people just don't have the patience or don't care. Okay, so that's just a simple intervention. This is why you need to find out what's going on. Okay, and then if you can get more information about what brought the person to this place.
Okay, we prepared him. And maybe she did a role play before I showed this, because this is a little bit ancillary.
Yeah.
You want to do it? You've been trained?
No. You're the expert, actually.
Okay. All right, well, let's see what happens to me. Hello. I'm Dr. C.
It's John. I want to speak to John. I was one-on-one with him. Why isn't he here? Why?
Who's this person? I don't know.
There's John. I only want to speak to him.
Well, Nurse John is not available.
Why isn't he available? Why? Only him I can talk to. I don't want to talk to you right now.
How can I help you?
Get John.
Okay, I can try to see if he's around.
Get him right now.
Okay, but what else can I do?
the medication. Stop it. Not good. Try to push me. What on me, Ted?
What does the medication do?
It does a cake. Okay.
I can talk about that. So tell me what kind of problems do you have with medication?
Trying to poison you. Oh, I'll be dead.
So you don't think the medication is helpful?
Mm-hmm. Of course not. You're trying to kill me.
Okay.
You're watching me.
What else can I do to help?
Family.
You want me to contact the family?
No. I hate them all. They're all against me.
Must be very hard to not have anyone to talk to or feel comfortable with.
That's why I want to talk. I want to take a job.
Well, I'm sorry you're struggling so much. And I know we haven't met before, but I'm here and trying to be helpful to you.
You want to kill me, don't you?
No, I don't think I want to. So we have a number of options. And I think you're looking angry. And you're scaring people.
Fine.
You're scaring me.
Of course, you're just laughing behind me. You're not scared. You're just laughing at me.
No, I think you're a big, strong guy. And when you get angry and upset, you can be intimidated. There are other
Is that why you're trying to twist me?
No.
Scared me?
Well, I'm not trying to hurt you. But we need to come up with a solution because you could get hurt and other people could get hurt. So we need to do something about that.
Who would be better off dead? Everyone wants to be dead.
Well, I understand you're quite distraught today. And I want to help you. I may not be able to right away. I'm going to try to get the nurse that you want. But what if I do not get him? What's the next best thing?
I don't know. I don't know.
Would it help to contact your family?
Maybe mom.
Okay. I can try to reach out to her. Do you think that if we change the medications, maybe we can try a combination that could be helpful?
So it's not poison.
Okay. I hear you. You don't like the medication. You think it's hurting you. But it's helped in the past, and maybe a different combination could be more, could be better. Hmm?
Maybe.
Well, thank you. We can go on like this.
Oh, we have to put the fire escape.
You want to hire him?
Very good.
I have a question actually about the disruption of narrative model of why violence occurs. Is that pretty much accepted as like this is the way why?
I just made it up for this.
Oh. I was just wondering if there are competing different theories that might be useful for people to understand more than one model, or is that pretty much what this was?
The narrative perspective is, if you want to. A cry from the past. Mm-hmm. I think the last 20 years in science and certainly in medicine have been dominated by hard evidence. Mm-hmm. Actually, the evidence-based medicine has been kind of taking over the entire world as, if you want, the ultimate standard. Mm-hmm. So there are lists of the strength of the evidence and randomized control designs are the best. And clinical impression anecdotes are the worst. So in this, on this map, the narrative or a personalized story about the patient may not may not be, if you want, the accepted model today. Mm-hmm. But I think in dealing with individual cases, mm-hmm. I feel that makes a lot of sense. When you have to deal with somebody who's very distraught, mm-hmm. if I tell him that the best available evidence was published 2 years ago and showed that, you know, 20 milligrams of Abilify would work best for psychosis, I'm not so sure that you would feel the warmth from the end of it. You know? But the reality, it could be that evidence is right. He's psychotic, and he tried various medications. Some of them made him fat and pushed his triglycerides up and raised his blood pressure. If I switch him to Abilify, in 2 months, he'll get better. But dealing with the immediate issue, I think it's just it's something else, and that knowledge about medication, while helpful in the long run, will not make it very good. So this is why I kind of came up with it, if you want, for the purpose of this meeting, with a way of kind of creating a metaphor that could sustain my verbal and nonverbal, if you want, escalation. I'm trying to create some sense, some coherence, some meaning to that interaction. And in doing that, I'm empathic, and I'm trying to channel the energies in a way that it's almost like a beginning. He's distraught, he's ready to give up, he's ready to shut himself away from the world. I'm trying to reach out to him without becoming his friend, without becoming his brother or father, but I'm trying to. And I think, in a sense, I'm restoring the meaning of his narrative. Mm. Somebody cares, somebody reaches out to him.
Because it seems like a very interesting system for people, for designers to play with. Like the idea of trying, even though there is this distorted narrative, and you may not know enough about the narrative to be able to act on it, but you can find out things about it by talking to the patient. And what you're really trying to do is make things fit within that person's narrative.
You're filling the blanks
yeah.
that were kind of somewhat destroyed by. By events, and it could be a variety of events. Mm-hmm. And at times you have to use the imagination. In a sense, it's almost like the intuition. I mean, I know the principles in every case, but how I'm going to do it, it's not pre-programmed.
And it seems like that's also something that you can play with from a design point of view. This idea of its disrupted narrative, and then how do you put it back, you know, just like putting the pieces back together might be something that you can do.
That may be the reason, and that's not a speculation, I'm just making this up, why adventure games are so powerful. Mm. Because in a sense you're finding a substitute narrative that is much more controllable than your own.
Yeah.
And for the time of the game you're there. It's almost like kind of you're buying a few minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes of a different storyline.
Actually, one of our researchers here looks specifically at adventure games, and her point of view is that playing an adventure game is like being a performer who hasn't been given the script. You're still an actor in the story, and you have to figure out what this bad story is in order to move along. So that fits really well. Mm-hmm. There's one other thing that I do want to bring up. Obviously, I don't want any of these games that you guys are working on to be quizzes, to be like really fun quizzes even. It's like, no, that's not what this class is about. I do want you guys to be designing games, not just Trivial Pursuit psychiatry version. That's kind of pointless. We have had games in the past in this class where people basically pulled questions out of a hat and had to answer them, and there were like various penalties. That were kind of fun, but that's not what I've been teaching you. So try to think about systems. Try to think about all these things that they want their trainees to learn. You know, think about how they can engage with the system. You know, in some small way.
What are your thoughts, or what are the field's thoughts, I guess, on lying to people to like mitigate a situation?
Well, I would call lying a distortion, and it's very in a general way. And when people lie, they have to make a decision. Often, people lie for a variety of reasons. What I always am surprised by is the reason to make friends, to get friendly, to resolve a situation. Okay, and I don't believe in lying as a communication tool, even if it may make things easier in the short run. Certainly, clinically, it's not helpful. I was telling you about patients with borderline pathology that have this affective and relational instability that is basically taking over their life. They are some of the most accurate lie detectors that you can imagine. You cannot design something more perfect than that, especially having been in the system for a long time. They can feel the lie even before it comes up. And then if you're going that path, you're dead.
So in this role play, for example, if you told Bobby, well, let me go get John, you wait here for a minute, and then you know that John isn't working right now, he's nowhere in the hospital, but you just told him that to so you can get out, and then you get security to come back in with you, and then you can subdue him or something.
That's a great example, and that happens all the time, because often when you're in this place, many of your requests are unreasonable, so you need to set some limits. And eventually you'll end up setting some limits. You could have continued to escalate until kind of attacking me, breaking everything in the room. I usually tell them about how they make others feel, how unacceptable some of the behaviors are, and what are the consequences. Okay. So I'm going to probably tell you, if this continues, I don't have any other choice but to call security and you end up in restraints. With the chemical medication given to you injectably, you could take it by mouth. So I'm coming up front with how the next few minutes, the proximal future looks like, as opposed to trying to kind of fudge it and kind of get on his friendly side and, oh, I don't mean anything, but the security will put you in strings. You know what I mean? So I don't want to buy him out by just becoming his friend. If that involves lying, that's, some people do it. When you're in a corner, okay, so what do I do now? A little lie won't hurt, and you do it. Maybe it's just my
yes, and what you just mentioned, too, that sort of like good cop, bad cop, well, I wish we could have more conversation here, but security needs to put you in your state. Security is the bad guy when,
right.
That's exactly where you want the patient to be anyways, because they're not...
I'm okay with it, but I know Jim, doesn't bother. He's the director, and he's going to, follow the law. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, but I mean, I guess the follow-up is like, would you ever secretly put medicine in someone's food or do something nervous and just kind of...
It's not only, a lawsuit waiting to happen,
yeah.
of a major magnitude, but I don't think it's right
for me.
Even though probably reality is that family members and sometimes even providers and nursing homes may do that, but I think it's
and you may need to treat the person against their will, which is often meaning putting them into physical restraints, which is usually like leather kinds of things that can, kind of a straitjacket thing, or maybe to a bed, and maybe physically inject them with something to really sedate them. But you should always be telling them what you're going to do, right? And the reason why you're doing it, even if they don't have any choice in that.
And if you feel that the person is unable to comprehend, then you may need to kind of work towards appointing a guardian who will take decisions for that person. So, and it's not necessarily that the legal field has pushed itself very hard in this field, but I think it's fair. Okay, you meet the person where that person is at and try to be helpful. And I think, in my view, there is no substitute for being upfront and saying, what's going to happen? He may not be my best friend, but he knows exactly. I'm telling the patients often ahead what's going to happen, in the sense that I'm giving them choices. So if I end up taking them to court for commitment, they know that. And they would be surprised, you would be surprised how, how angry they are at the beginning and how okay they are later, and how often they come up to me and say, thank you, I was in a very bad space, but, and I know I didn't want to, and I fought you all the way, but I think that was the best solution for me. And I don't necessarily do that to get that... thanks. I just do it as a principle. It often doesn't come, so it's not like people are grateful. Often they leave the hospital.
Let me show a little bit of this
this change is just a few minutes. This is the project I've been working on a lot for NASA, which is basically to develop a mental health support system for the long-duration space crews. And this was kind of a whole other topic, but just one piece of this was teaching the astronauts how to manage conflict, interpersonal conflict, more effectively. For state, astronauts being a very different population from who we're talking about. We don't have any sound.
Let's just probably turn down the other. Is it on turned up on the other computer?
Let's just see. I just checked the mute.
It's probably just turned on.
I'm sorry. It just turned off. Down below. Can you talk about there?
And then I'll adjust it from there.
Okay.
Should we be hearing something at this point?
Not yet.
Welcome to the virtual space station, where you can access training and resources to help deal with the stresses of long-duration space flights. In the training simulator, you'll interact with virtual crew members to learn and practice managing some of the problems that might come up on long-duration missions. The resources module has more advanced training that you can do to learn about adapting to the stresses of living in isolation, plus interviews with long-duration flyers. It also has a number of ebooks and audiobooks on dealing with stress, plus survival stories about polar missions and other adventures. In the self-assessment module, you'll find questionnaires that can help you.
I'm going to skip out of this. This is basically the whole interface, but all I'll show you here is our simulator.
This is the training simulator. Click on the topic you would like to learn about. Then the coach or mentor for that topic will take over and guide you through.
This is the conflict management part of the simulator. We recommend that you do the 10-minute briefing first. After you complete each simulation, I am Les Greenhouse, your conflict management coach. Here's how these simulations work. You are Flight Engineer 1, or FE1, and your crewmate, Chuck, is Flight Engineer 2. We'll be giving you three choices of what to say or do. You can roll your mouse over them to hear how they're said. Even though some options are more likely than others to reduce the conflict, I recommend that you try out options you might not choose in real life. That's because all paths in these simulations lead to teaching points. You can click the backup button anytime if you want to change your choice and go down another pathway. You can click on the Fair Fighting Manual at any time to read some tips. You'll also find this manual in the Resource Modules library. Now, as you go through the simulation, I'll be right here coaching you along the way. Okay, back to the simulation. It's 4 months into your mission with 5.5 left to go. So far, the mission's been going pretty well, but you're both tired, having had to sleep shift last night.
Hey, is your display getting squirrely? Shoot, mine too. Damn it, the whole system's down. It was the wrong cabling. Yeah, when I was installing the recorder, I disconnected the A10 cable. I mean, I fixed it right away, but I think it screwed up the whole system. Hey, look. If ground calls up, don't tell them about the cabling.
Ah, this is a tricky situation. You believe it's important to tell the ground what happened. At the same time, you don't want Chuck to get in trouble. What's your response?
They'll spend hours trying to figure this out. We got to tell what's wrong with telling the ground, okay? But you're putting me...
Make a choice.
Okay, you're putting me in a bad position.
No, but thanks. You're a real friend. I owe you big time. Yeah, Houston, this is FE2. Go ahead. No, negative. I have no idea. Yeah, I know. Well, I already got the reboot started, right? I guess it's too early to say what the impact is. Roger that. I'll let you know if it happens again. FE2 out.
You're feeling very anxious, having just heard Chuck lie to the ground. You're worried that this might backfire on you if the ground finds out that you knew what happened. This makes you very angry at Chuck. How would you like to respond?
So the reason I'm showing you guys this is that this is one approach that I've taken to teaching how to handle an interaction with somebody through sort of a simulation. Now, this is obviously not a game. There's no score. There's no time limit. It's more of an interactive movie. But with the teaching points here, just like what Caesar's given you, is, you know, we can give this to an astronaut, and they'll read it in 5-10 minutes and say, yep, got it, what's the next thing? But that doesn't mean they actually can use it, they remember it, they've absorbed it. So, and I'm not saying that this is the way that you should do your games, but just that this is one approach that we've taken to try to get them more involved with the kind of material in more of a kind of a simulated way. You can just maybe do one or two of these. What would you like to do here?
Chuck, we need to talk about this.
What is there to talk about? Brown doesn't need to know every single little detail, all right? Plus, if we do tell him, next thing you know, we're going to be all over the news. This was a good choice. Even though Chuck seems exasperated, you know what's going on in his mind. Understanding what each other is thinking goes a long way to solving conflict. Chuck is concerned about the ruckus this might cause, and about negative media attention. But now you have something to work with. What's your next move?
Sure.
I know you don't. You've been doing excellent work so far. I can see you're really scared of him.
Hey.
I know you don't want to draw a lot of attention. But what do you think will happen if they figure it out?
Yeah, okay, you got a point. I'd be fried. Especially if it looked like I was trying to cover it up. You know, this really is a team issue. On the one hand, you seem to get Chuck to come around to your perspective that the ground really needs to know what happened. On the other hand, he's asking you to share the responsibility, even though it really wasn't your fault. You have mixed feelings. You don't want to be blamed for a mistake you didn't make, but you're concerned about keeping a good relationship with Chuck. How are you going to respond?
We'll just do one more of these and wrap up.
I'm sorry, Chuck, but this was your mistake. So you have to take responsibility for it.
Ground.
Yeah.
B.
Yeah.
B.
B.
Okay. No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's invisible to ground control.
That's a good idea. Houston, this is FB2.
Go ahead,
FB2. Houston, I think we found the problem. The instructions you sent up for the recorder had some serious problems. When you follow the recorder connect procedure, you can end up disconnecting the A10. It may need to be validated.
Copy that, FB2. The procedures team ran through this in the mock-up, but they can give it another look.
In any organization, things go wrong. Sometimes this can help to create a bond within the work group, because everybody has a common enemy. But even though scapegoating the ground may keep the crew unified for a while, there's a serious cost. Obviously, okay, so a rift between space and ground.
You kind of get the idea. We'd like to be available by email in case you guys have any questions. So
I'll send out contact information to the pass list, and we're probably going to spend the rest of this week bringing them up. So we're not quite sure exactly what we're working on yet, but hopefully you can find out the article on the 7th website. And I just have a couple of more admin things to deal with. But I want to thank you guys for this. Okay. So let's see. On next Wednesday, which is the Wednesday right before Thanksgiving, I think a couple of folks are probably going to be like heading out for the. Because I've been hearing some like nasty stuff about like what the TSA might be doing and what people might be doing with in response to TSA. yeah. Getting to the airport early if you're flying out might be a good idea. Because if everybody decides to refuse the back scanner scans and the body searches, then we're talking about some new delays. Anyway, so I think what I'm going to do is early call up once it's passed. But if there are teams who are really wanting to do a live action game and they want to sort of get a head start on that, talk to me directly, and maybe what we can do is we can just sort of like meet up with you guys as a team and sort of come talk, try to get some ideas across, do like a brainstorming with me. I will still get into talking about live action games the following week. I'll schedule one of the classes for that. So we're not going to miss that topic at all. Just gonna be, I just worry that if we get to it too late and you're making a live action game, then you don't actually have enough material to work with. Let's see, so that's the class on Friday. And finally, about this assignment, if the subject matter, you know, is a little uncomfortable for you to work with, and you know, and you can't really find something that in this fairly large topic that you will be comfortable working with, you know, you can't find a team. Again, talk to me directly, and you know, and can work out some other assignment. I can't say that I have an assignment in my back pocket already to go, and more likely than not, I'm half-assing it too. I would much prefer folks to work on this problem because I think it's fascinating, and I think it's a pretty big problem that you can find some small part that you can work with. But if you are, I don't want to put anyone, I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable to do their homework, basically. So just talk to me and we'll pick us up. Something up, okay?
Thank you. Thanks.